I decided to cover three topics. They're disparate but connected. Okay. I'm a postdoctoral fellow at UC Berkeley. Some of the work I'm going to be talking to you about was done in collaboration with Adam Burrows of Arizona, Phil Pinto of Arizona, and Brad Meyer of Clemson. I have a talk that has three parts to its title. I'm going to use only two parts, really, in my outline here. First, I'm going to introduce the supernova problem for those of you who may or may not be familiar with it, some scales, important processes, etc. I'm going to talk about our efforts to construct dynamical models of core collapse supernovae in one dimension. I'm going to talk particularly about the breakout phenomena, the electron neutrino breakout phenomena that accompanies core collapse, spectrum formation, and some things about detector signatures and variations in all those quantities if you fool around with microphysics inside the supernova. Then I'm going to quickly transition to proneutron star winds. And I'm going to talk about neutrino-driven outflows and nucleosynthesis, particularly our process nucleosynthesis. And then I'm going to speculate, hand wave, and put twiddles on the page having to do with magnetic fields. In the end, I'll hopefully conclude, as all things do. All right, so the supernova problem. We start with a progenitor. It might be 11 solar masses, 15 solar masses, 20 solar masses, and more. Here is 15 solar masses. A 15 solar mass progenitor might live for several million years, many million years. Its radius might be 10 to the 12 to 10 to the 13 centimeters. Here you've got an onion skin structure, hydrogen, helium, silicon, etc., all the way down to an iron core. That iron core encounters a dynamical instability, the Chandrasekhar instability, when its average adiabatic index drops below about 4/3. And even though it may have lived for these millions of years, it collapses on a dynamical time, which is less than a second. As the core collapses, the density in the core rises along with the temperature. The density in a progenitor might be 10 to the 10 grams per cubic centimeter, and it increases to nuclear densities, or thereabouts, over 2 times 10 to the 14 grams per cubic centimeter. At that point, there's a phase transition. So you did have heavy nuclei. Those heavy nuclei dissociate into neutrons and protons, and the adiabatic index goes from less than 4/3 to 3 or something more. That turns the implosion of this white dwarf-like object into an explosion. It drives a strong sound wave that steepens into a shock, and that shock might move initially at 30,000 kilometers per second. That's the bounce or the prompt shock. Importantly, and this is a robust conclusion of all dynamical models, including those that I'm going to show you today, that shock stalls as a result of several competing factors. And it doesn't make it to infinity immediately. It stops at a radius of maybe 200, 300 kilometers. And what you have then in that case is you have material infalling onto this standoff accretion shock. And you have the protoneutron star. I say protoneutron star because it's not a neutron star like you're used to thinking about. It's maybe 50 kilometers in radius. It has a temperature of 10 MeV and a tenuous outer atmosphere.
Central density at that time would be what?
2.3 times 10 to the 14 to 2.9 times 10 to the 14. Somehow, the explosion makes it to infinity. We know because we see supernovae explode. And the neutron star contracts and cools over a Kelvin-Helmholtz time, maybe 10 to 20 seconds, deleptonizing and cooling to a radius that's maybe more familiar, something like 10 kilometers. Just to make this a little more concrete, well, I'll give you some numbers. So what is a core collapse supernova? It's many of these things. It's a dynamical instability. It's the birth of a neutron star or a black hole. It's an agent for chemical and dynamical galactic evolution. Some characteristic numbers, total kinetic energy, 10 to the 51 ergs. Luminous energy radiated, maybe 10 to the 49 ergs. That's in photons. It's a temperature scale, 10 to the 11 Kelvin is representative. Densities of interest in this tenuous phase when we're trying to decide whether the supernova is going to succeed or not are densities between 10 to the 9 and 10 to the 14 grams per cubic centimeter. Neutrino production. I mean, the total kinetic energy and luminous energy radiated are large. The neutrino energy radiated is prodigious, 2 to 3 times 10 to the 53 ergs. That's radiated over several seconds. And the core is opaque to neutrinos of all flavors with a diffusion timescale of order a second. So I'll show a movie. This is from Burrows, Hayes, and Frixell. This is to give you an idea. This is the core of a 15 solar mass progenitor. This is 300 kilometers on a side. What you're seeing is electron fraction. If you'd like me to talk about that more, I will. What happens is the core collapses. and it bounces. And this is the shock wave. The shock stalls and contracts. There's neutrinos streaming out of here, which heat this material, causing it to be convectively unstable. This is your standoff accretion shock. So at this point, you have the standoff accretion shock. You have this region behind the shock that's convectively unstable, that being driven by heating from neutrinos, which are coming from this white line. That's the electron neutrino sphere. This region right here is a region of net neutrino cooling.
Todd, you said that was electron fraction. Is that really a dimensionless thing that you're...
Yeah, this is the number density of electrons minus the number density of positrons over the number density of baryons. And this is a number around 0.5, and this is a number around probably 0.2, 0.3, and this is a number around closer to 0.3. So I don't have YU profiles to talk about. Any questions? Double click. So it boils and roils, and the shock eventually moves out to infinity right now.
What kind of timetable is it at this point?
So what you just saw there was about 200 milliseconds of evolution from the time of bounce until the time of explosion. What you're going to see in this last phase is this wind right here. Whoosh. Right there.
What's that wind?
That wind is actually driven by neutrinos. So what you still have is a very high luminosity of neutrinos escaping on this time scale. So even though the shock is moving off at 10 or 20,000 kilometers per second, what's happening is the shock's moving out. This region behind the shock is decreasing in pressure between the neutron star.
But
and that shock.
The wind is a rather narrow jet there.
Well, narrow jet NYE. What's happened here is that because of those plumes that were dropping onto the neutron star due to convection, you've excited G-modes. Those G-modes move back and forth in this calculation, and they cause regions of high temperature. That region of high temperature is giving you this difference in YE across this plume. Whether or not such plumes exist in real multidimensional calculations. Or as a general phenomenon, I can't tell you.
Well, how should I think of these color coding here? Because you're plotting YE, but can I think of that as material moving out?
Yeah, you can think of it as material moving out. Yes.
So is this a three-dimensional simulation?
It's a two-dimensional axisymmetric.
So are you going to compare this with, say, some of the work in Metzger?
I'm not, actually. I meant mostly just to... I'm going to talk about Metzger-Kaplan and Liebendorfer's work later when I talk about my one-dimensional simulations. Right now, I just wanted to give everyone the physical picture.
In other words, the question is, how robust are these features?
These features are not very robust. The neutrino transport in this calculation is exceedingly poor. And Adam is in effort trying to do better two-dimensional calculations as we speak. Again, I just wanted to set the scene. So what you have at any time, just taking a snapshot from a different calculation that looks a lot the same, you have a standoff accretion shock, and it's sort of in steady state for maybe 100 milliseconds, 200 milliseconds, 300 milliseconds. There's lots of things going on. It's convectively unstable in this region of heating. There's this region of cooling, which I pointed out. There's mass flux, iron dropping through the shock, disassociating into neutrons and protons. And there's a region here, maybe at 60 kilometers, where the neutrinos are decoupling. Neutrinos are decoupling here, region of cooling, region of heating that's convectively unstable, mass flux coming in. The heating is by these processes with the arrows going that way, and the cooling is mostly by these processes with the arrows going that way, here. So what have we endeavored to do? So I showed you a two-dimensional calculation, which looks nice, but the neutrino transport and the nuclear physics are quite poor in that calculation. So in an effort to do a precision job in one dimension, there have been several groups that have tried to construct models just in 1D. There's Romp and Janka, 2000-2002, Liebendorfer and Liebendorfer et al., 2000-2001. So that's Liebendorfer and Metzger-Kaplan. What we've done is something, we've constructed a code that can be compared with those. And it's one-dimensional. It employs Lagrangian hydrodynamics. It's Newtonian, explicit, uses artificial viscosity for shock resolution. We couple that to a high-density equation of state. The standard in the field right now is the Latimer-Swesty equation of state, which uses the liquid drop model of nuclei. This is 1991. We couple that to a neutrino transport algorithm. We follow three neutrino species, electron neutrinos, anti-electron neutrinos, and muon neutrinos, in quotes, where muon neutrinos is nu mu bar, nu tau bar. Assuming all those microphysics of those species to be the same. Microphysics is state-of-the-art neutrino opacities, emission absorption. We've developed a new inelastic scattering algorithm, so you can have inelastic neutrino scattering on charged leptons, and we include nucleon-nucleon bremsstrahlung. The great thing, and this is where I will talk about Metzekap and Liebendorfer and Rampignanka, is that these are three independent efforts, all with a full solution to the Boltzmann equation, different schemes for hydrodynamics, totally different interpretations of everything, and the numbers are quite alike. I would say that in one dimension, the supernova field is really converged on models that at least each of us can reproduce the other's results. There have been numerous tests and verification of this code, and I'll refer you to Thompson et al. 2002.
Where does convection come in?
Excuse me, this is one dimension. There is no convection.
That's right.
Yes, that's right.
Is that a problem?
Yes, it is a problem.
What's the logic of going back to one dimension?
The logic of going back to one dimension is that, at least from my perspective, about every few years, someone comes into the field, will write, say, a paper saying, you know, there's this neutrino interaction, it's important, it hasn't been included, we've solved the supernova problem. My personal opinion is that there's a lot of feedbacks in this problem. It's nonlinear, it's complicated. The best thing to do, I can run, you know, maybe 50 models in a week, exploring some dial, some parameter space, whereas any two-dimensional calculation that employs a full solution to the Boltzmann equation, which is what we think we need now, is very, I mean, you're talking months, 5 months, 6 months. And so that's why we've developed this facility.
No one has ever done that, right?
Sorry?
Boltzmann calculation in 2D.
In 2D, a full two-dimensional Boltzmann equation coupled to hydrodynamics, no. But we're getting close. I think in the next year or two, you will see that. The nearest right now, let me just point out, is Hans Thomas Janke and his group in Garching, where they have their calculation is like this, and they're doing one-dimensional Boltzmann equation transport along rays. It's as sophisticated a solution as this solution is in 1D along rays. There's no angular transport. So this is what we've done. So I have constructed this little movie. You're going to see luminosity and velocity. This is, again, just to put things in perspective. This will repeat. Okay. Just look at the black line. Don't look at the red line. All right, just black. So what you're seeing is the velocity curve starts at zero velocity, it drops, and then you see a shock form and move out. Now, let me see if I can do this. Okay, so here, that was just after bounce. Now the shock forms. It's a positive velocity there. This is 1 times 10 to the 9, 2 times 10 to the 9, 3 times 10 to the 9 centimeters per second. And it stalls.
And that's the motion
of the shock, the hydrodynamical shock. So what you see is that you start here.
And that's a radial profile just defined by the mass.
This is a radial profile defined by the mass. This is interior mass, that's 1.4 solar masses. So you see collapse and bounce. And the shock, of course, always moves out in mass. It keeps gobbling up mass as it just sits there. So it always moves out in the mass coordinate. But in the radial coordinate, it stalls at about 200 kilometers. And what you see in the red, sorry?
Your spherical code relativistic?
The spherical code is not relativistic. It's purely a Newtonian calculation. At this point, you can expect a neutron star. The neutron star radius is about 50 or 60 kilometers in the standoff phase. So you're talking about corrections that are on the order of 10%. Okay. And then what you see in the red is a building of a luminosity, the electron neutrino luminosity, the local electron neutrino luminosity. What you're going to see is as the shock plows through iron, remember this is iron, this is free neutrons and protons, but this is all degenerate. We start with a degenerate iron core. The electrons capture on protons, produce electron neutrinos. Those electron neutrinos are trapped because the density is so high here. You build this local luminosity of electron neutrinos, and then you cross the tau is 2/3, or the optical depth unity sphere for the electron neutrinos, and you'll see that red pulse propagate ahead of the shock. So right here, that's this pulse here. Right here, it's going to move off to infinity, and that's sapping the shock of energy. And that's what you see at infinity. So let me show you another picture. So you have nuclei, free protons, a mass flux, and this pulse, once it's attenuated, escapes to infinity, and that's what hits you in the eye if you're super K.
So that's just the neutronization pulse?
Just the neutronization pulse. This is breakout, and this is what initially saps the shock of energy.
And this is a few hundred milliseconds?
No, this actually, let me give you a good time scale right here. This shows the whole profile in mass. This is the whole envelope of solutions. And you can see that this is that strong pulse that was formed and then is attenuated. And it's this thing right here that escapes to infinity. So this is 1.5 milliseconds after bounce. 1.8 milliseconds after bounce, 2.4, 3.2, 6.8 milliseconds after bounce. So the actual death of the shock takes less than 10 milliseconds. And what you see here, if I plot the radio or in time, I'm plotting the coordinate of each of our mass shells in radius. So this is 1,000 kilometers, 100 kilometers, 10 kilometers. You can see everything falls in. There's a hydrodynamical bounce. The shock is created at between 100 and 200 kilometers. Mass flux infalls, and this is the protoneutron star here. You can see it's at a radius of 50 or 60 kilometers at this point. And this is this very subsonic accretion flow, which occurs where there would be convection if you had 2D. Again, this is 1D calculation. There is no convection. Luminosity at infinity looks like this. Electron neutrino luminosity, this is the neutronization burst. Anti-electron neutrino luminosity and mu neutrino luminosity. That's mu, that's all four. So this is sum, all four.
Which is the neutronization?
It's the big pulse of electron neutrinos. Yeah. And so this here, this is 10 to the 53. That is 1 times 10 to the 53 ergs per second. This is 2.5 times 10 to the 53 ergs per second. Average energies look like this. This is the hierarchy you always hear. Muon neutrinos here. Anti-electron neutrinos slightly lower. Electron neutrinos slightly lower. 10 MeV, 15 MeV, 20 MeV as a function of time at infinity. The code, as I mentioned, is spectral. This is to give you an idea of what the spectrum looks like. This is 0 MeV, 50 MeV. This is for mu neutrinos. The dark solid line is electron neutrinos, and the anti-electron neutrinos is the solid thin line. So you can get we typically employ 40 energy groups per species, so it's fully spectral.
I mean, we discussed the debate about those spectra issues of what goes into them and the question of the things that Rafael just brought up and says that differences isn't so great.
Well, the difference between, say, for example, the electron and anti-electron, or between the mu and the rest?
The mu and the rest.
I think we're felt. The predominant effect on the mu neutrinos is scattering. Mu neutrino scattering on electrons. So right now I have scattering in there, so the mu neutrinos exchange energy with charged leptons. It's a full energy redistribution, the full integral on the right-hand side of the Boltzmann equation. If I didn't include that, this energy would be up close to 26 MeV at this point. All the energies would be correspondingly higher, but for the mu neutrinos, it's the largest decrement. As far as bremsstrahlung, which he emphasizes, nucleon-nucleon bremsstrahlung, I'm going to get to those effects in just a moment. So the code spectral. The code is also, even in one-dimensional transport, you have to resolve the angular distribution function, right? Even at each point, if your radiation field, if you're in a pure diffusive regime, your radiation field is isotropic. That means if you made a polar plot of the radiation field, it should be a circle. And that's what you see here. At a particular point after bounce, you see that for 320 MeV, neutrinos are totally trapped. That is, the distribution function of neutrinos is isotropic in angle. This is a polar plot. Whereas for lower energy neutrinos, in this case 1 MeV, the distribution is starting to become decoupled from the matter, and it's forward peaked. And so this gives you between 1 MeV and 320 MeV, all of our 40 energy groups. And you can see these dots represent our angular binning, in this case 149 angles per quadrant on the unit circle. So what have we done with this machinery, which was sort of the last part of my last chapter of my thesis? We did sort of the zeroth project. And the zeroth project is to first run a bunch of different progenitors. In this case, for my thesis, we just did 11, 15, and 20. We have since worked on 30, 40, and 75 solar masses. And then tweak things, right? This is the great thing about the one-dimensional simulations, that I can take all my opacities, divide them by 10, and run again, and I get an answer in 3 days. Whereas in a two-dimensional calculation, that takes longer. We've assessed the effects of nucleon-nucleon bremsstrahlung, inelastic neutrino scattering, weak magnetism and recoil corrections. And then with the Latimer-Swesty equation of state, we've actually run our baseline, our fiducial model, with three different values of the nuclear compressibility modulus. That's the first time that's been done. Then we folded our signals with different detectors. In this case,
I'm sorry, what does the by 10 mean there?
Oh, we just took all of our neutral current scattering rates off of neutrons and protons and divided them by 10. Just to see what happens. Just an example. So the first thing is different progenitors, 11, 15, and 20 solar masses. One interesting thing is that the neutronization burst is almost identical for each progenitor. You can see the differences here. This is electron neutrino luminosity versus time at infinity. You can see that the accretion luminosity is much larger in this case for the 20 solar mass object. This is for a nuclear compressibility modulus of 180 MeV, and this is for a nuclear compressibility modulus of 375 MeV. So this is as much leeway as we have with the Latimer-Swesty equation of state. The one thing that you can tweak is the compressibility modulus. We changed it by a factor of 2, which Swesty has made easy to do. And this is the entire difference in this case. I mean, all the pressures are computed. Everything's, I mean, the whole equation of state is consistent, and you can see the differences are not very significant.
That's surprising. I mean, the soft equation of state, you would think you would fall farther into the potential well.
Yeah.
Liberate more energy than the static amount of neutrinos.
Yeah, but in this case, it's the
Well,
I'm sure that they become more different later on. I mean, again, our focus was sort of on this neutronization burst and this region. I'm sure that later
they might also get denser and then trap them more easily.
Well, maybe. I don't want to say too much. I know that during collapse, even though the chemical potential of the neutron and the chemical potential of the proton, that difference is what determines, for example, the core YE at bounce, and which determines a lot of the subsequent dynamics. And those are almost identical in these calculations. And so the initial shock energy is almost the same. So this is with and without Bremsstrahlung for the muon neutrinos. You can see that the luminosity for the muon neutrinos is affected at the 20% level. And the average energy is affected at a smaller level. Importantly, so with Bremsstrahlung, you bring the average energy down. That makes sense because Bremsstrahlung is peaked at lower energies, whereas E plus E minus annihilation to nu bar, which is your other major production process, is peaked
by
at much higher.
You mean a nucleon-nucleon collision?
I mean nucleon-nucleon Bremsstrahlung. Yeah.
That seems like a tiny effect compared with what Georg was.
Yeah, and I'm trying to diagnose exactly what the difference is. But in this case, again, if I take out neutrino electron scattering, another thermalization process for the muon neutrinos, then the effect of Bremsstrahlung turning it on or off is larger. But with neutrino electron scattering, that's the dominant thing. That brings down the average energy significantly. And so, I mean, the luminosity is raised at the 20% level.
That phenomenon has been known for a long, long time.
Yeah, no, that's right.
You saturate down scattering by any one of the electron
that's right.
processes.
And this is, I mean, in essence, I think you're seeing that. And the luminosity, I mean, this difference in luminosity has been predicted by Riffelt, by Burroughs et al., 2000. I mean, that's about the magnitude of the effect you would see. I thought you'd see
it
lower.
The trouble is, though, I say things like this from time to time, Todd. You'll have to forgive me.
That's fine.
Because you're used to it, right?
I am.
The trouble is that to go back to why you were willing to reduce the neutral stuff by 10, well, that's because there's been some serious consideration by now over generations of people with Ab and myself and you and
that's right.
Guys at Stony Brook, and we found this extraordinary dependence on rather well-measured nuclear parameters, the Fermi liquid parameters. It was done systematically looking at the definition of the rates in terms of the expectation values of the relevant densities in thermal field theory or thermal quantum mechanics, correct statistical mechanics, and there were these big negative effects. Mm-hmm. Now, when Riffelt set out to calculate these things, he took this graph, your exchanger thing. You have a scattering that happens, and then you add an inelastic thing in the medium by exchanging a guy, and you square it, and you get something positive. That positive thing is all subsumed in the very negative corrections that we made. Because, number one, they left out a graph. Number two, they did an expansion in a case where the interactions are so strong and repulsive that you can't do an expansion. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, they put in some other graph involving another particle, which made them think, okay, here's another channel for opacity, okay? It's demonstrably false, it's been just demonstrated false, it's not what you and Adam are using for the neutrino nucleon scattering anymore, although it's probably what Yonka and his friends are using. But now we start over again with the Brimshaw, and we do the same damn thing. We write down this graph, which is totally unjustified. And instead of looking at the current correlation function using some knowledge from nuclear physics has failed us here. That's my comment, Wick. They've given positive corrections when the correction should be negative.
I see.
So all over it seems to me the capacities that people are using are still much, much too big. Now, I wouldn't be yelling, except I've been saying this for 15 years.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I didn't get the conclusion.
Yeah. Take the Brimshaw part out of here totally. Mm-hmm.
The Brimshaw, I mean, as you know, we...
And stick with your factor of 10.
We should forget Revell's calculations?
Sorry?
Yes.
So this Brimshaw rate is computed with a 1 pion exchange potential. There are problems associated with the correlations.
You're only wrong with the wrong sign.
The wrong sign in which sense? They get too much, too large an effect?
They have too large opacities, yes.
It means that basically... Well, you get the energy should be higher.
You put it back in the bottle and you see what it means. I don't know.
I think.
How much higher? I mean, you cut it by a factor of 10. You're about to tell us how much that made.
In this case, I was going to skip it actually, but if you'd like to know, if you decrease the opacity by a factor of 10, for example, the muon luminosity goes up by about a factor of 4. The electron neutrino and anti-electron neutrino luminosities are increased by 45% and 50%. Together. And it does affect the dynamics, but importantly, in all of these models, there are no explosions seen in 1D, even with that violence done to the cross sections.
I think what you said there is right, that a large change in opacity usually means a relatively much smaller effects on the supernova scale.
Well,
and the reason for that is just what you've been pointing out here is that basically the star is transparent to the lowest energy neutrinos.
That's right.
So as long as you've been careful in putting in inelastic reactions feed the low energy neutrino states as fast as they can be fed, and then if the star is completely transparent, they leave the star at the speed of light.
Yeah.
That downscattering reaction is the way the star gets rid of its energy.
Yeah.
So that's why large changes in opacity usually have relatively small effects on explosion dynamics.
I should point out that Liebendorfer, in his thesis, got an anomalous explosion. And he did because he decreased those neutral current scattering rates by a factor of 100. And that did it. Then he got a large gain region, lots of heating, and he was able to change the shock dynamics. And he's since, factors of 100. This case, I did a factor of 10, and you pick up a factor of 4 in muon neutrino luminosity. But,
Can you kind of summarize the uncertainties in the energy spectrum and deal with all this?
In view of all this, I would say that the uncertainties in the energy spectrum are still not well. I would say that we're talking about 20%, 10 to 20%, not more, in the luminosities at infinity.
I'm talking about the energy spectrum.
The spectra, the actual spectra. Yeah. So in order to get a spectra, I'd have to do a calculation for you. I'm trying to give you a sort of a general number. Those spectra, I think, I mean the gross properties, like I said, the luminosity and the average energy at infinity are probably not going to be changed by more than about 10-15%. Of course, what you see at infinity is going to be modified by oscillation effects and things which I haven't included here. But
neutrino mixing in this calculation.
No, there's no neutrino mixing in this calculation. If you put in the standard numbers for, say, solar neutrino parameters, you'll find that everything's pretty suppressed inside the supernova, inside the shock. There's really, if you admit a sterile neutrino, then there's possibilities of some interesting consequences. But
as long as people bring up miscellaneous topics, Rafael and his guys claim they put in neutrino scattering deep in the core, and it makes a difference. Would you comment on that?
Neutrino scattering is... Neutrino scattering can be, I mean, it can make a difference, but the way they're handling it, I guess I don't believe right now, because the actual calculation of that integral, you're adding a different nonlinear piece to the integral on the right-hand side as soon as you're doing neutrino scattering. And then you need to couple the Boltzmann equations for each. And so I'd be a little skeptical at this point. What they have included is nu bar goes to nu bar as a production process for, say, mu neutrinos. And in that case, that's a bit better than E plus E minus goes to nu bar. Because in this case, your phase space is restricted by the electron degeneracy factors. But those are unincluded in this calculation. The top one is not included in this calculation. So just quickly, so you can see what you might calculate if you took Icarus, which is an argon detector meant to calculate or meant to be able to detect electron neutrinos. You'd see this is the breakout burst. This is in dndt, number of events per unit time, and this is in 50 per second. So this is about 1,000 per second at the peak. And what you see is you get about 10 to 12 events in Icarus over this breakout burst. I'm just pointing this out as an example of some of the calculations that you can do with SuperK and with SNOW as well. So some of the a summary of the supernova models is that the dynamical we've constructed these dynamical models. We have spectra calculated for several different progenitors. These are available online if anybody's interested in doing neutrino oscillation studies, propagating spectra through the star, from the star to the Earth, through the Earth, please let me know. We have these available and I'm more than happy to share. We've assessed some of these equation of state and opacity variations, although much more work needs to be done, and some detection signals calculated. Importantly, no explosions in 1D, and the field has really converged on that. So, to change gears, I apologize for the discontinuity. Again, however the supernova happens, the shock is going to move out at some characteristic velocity. Maybe it's 10,000, maybe it's 20,000 kilometers per second. And when it does, you're going to evacuate this region behind the shock. The pressure will drop. And you might imagine that there's a wind, like the solar wind, except driven by neutrino energy deposition, which ablates material from the surface. And you can see this plume is going to come in and then be pushed out. Right here. See? Whoosh. I like to make the whoosh noise when I watch this. This is the wind phase, and we think that this is going to accompany neutron star cooling and formation. So, because I really haven't talked about observations except to fold things with the detectors in the previous graph, let me try to come back to observations and talk about nucleosynthesis. So, indirectly, you might expect that there are interesting nucleosynthetic products from this phase, and the question is, what is the origin of the heavy nuclei? Heavy, I mean, beyond the iron group nuclei we find in nature. There's two ways to make heavy nuclei, S process and the R process. So this gets in the second half of my title. So I want to talk about the R process, rapid neutron capture process. In this process, seed nuclei, which might be anything up to the iron group, or alpha R elements up to the iron group, neutron capture on timescales much shorter than those for beta decay. What that means is that if you hit a seed nucleus iron with a lot of neutrons, it captures neutrons, goes way up to the neutron-rich side of the valley of beta stability, and it can produce heavy elements in that way. So if the neutron-to-seed ratio is 100 to 1, you can produce the heaviest nuclei. And this ratio, 100 to 1, is set by the entropy and dynamical time scale and electron fraction of the environment. So if you go to this wind phase, you can remember that moving out, maybe. What you have in the wind phase is you have this neutron star that's going to be contracting and cooling. You have neutron, because it's so hot, it's 510 MeV, neutrons and protons are going to be on the surface. Those neutrons and protons are going to be ablated from the surface via energy deposition of neutrinos. And that matter is going to stream to infinity. As it does, the temperature and the density drop on that matter, on that wind. There's a temperature density profile. The matter cools. And you might form alpha particles, and then you might have alpha-alpha interactions, alpha-alpha-N, you might form seed nuclei. And so you might imagine that in this wind, there's matter streaming out, maybe right here, alpha particles form, and maybe further on, there's some rapid neutron capture process, if you can maintain.
You form in this region, you're plotting the C-nuclei?
You may, in this range, maybe later in this stage, because this wind evolution is going to last for 10 seconds. I've only shown you 50 milliseconds of evolution. In this phase, this matter is going to be driven off, and maybe out here, the matter, the neutrons and protons combine into alpha particles and further along into heavy nuclei.
So C nuclei are formed out there. Somewhere.
Yeah, out here.
That has to be part of the story.
That has to be part of the computation. In this case, it's certainly not part of this two-dimensional computation. I'm going to talk.
Be part of the story.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's not the onion skin before the supernova exploded. That is with the heavy elements.
No, I mean, you have heavy elements, you know, up to iron, and there's interesting nucleosynthesis as a shockwave propagates through the supernova, but you're going to produce very little, if any, R-process elements, and those R-process elements I'm going to tell you about more
This is the Big Bang in a nucleon soup, just more neutrons and protons.
Yeah. So in this case, this just shows you the R-process path in a graph of Z, proton number versus N, neutron number. You can see that it proceeds well to the neutron-rich side of the valley of beta stability. The important observation is the following. This is in green, you see the solar R-process abundances. So these are R-process abundances of barium, europium, osmium, etc. in green. You can see there are these two characteristic peaks. In red, you see the relative abundances of an ultra-metal poor halo star in the galaxy. So what you see, this ultra-metal poor means that its Fe over H is like -3, which means that it's old. It means that it formed early in the chemical enrichment history of the galaxy. If it's very old, what you find is that above this region right here, above this point in N, the relative R-process distribution matches that of the Sun. Almost exactly. Sneedon has a new plot of this, and it's even better than this one. But the correspondence is really remarkable through this region. And so what you guess from this is that if you have really old stuff that has some R-process distribution, and if you have other stuff like the Sun that has the same R-process distribution, then the idea might be that there's some universal way to make this R-process distribution. Remember, the absolute magnitudes of the R-process in those two stars, the Sun and this ultra-metal poor halo star, are very different, the absolute magnitudes. But the relative abundance is exactly the same.
What if you have a little gap there?
Here?
There's no point here.
Yeah, there's no point. It's in the second peak, and that's just because of this spectroscopic limitations. They're not able to resolve elements in the atmosphere. I mean, you can see them in the Sun, but you can't see them in this far-off halo star.
Just an observational instance.
And there are interesting discrepancies, of course, down here, but there aren't any discrepancies here. And this isn't just one star, even though I've only plotted one star, or Sneedon's only plotted one star. It's about 10 stars. There's a class of objects that are ultra-metal poor, that have been observed, that are R-process enriched, and they have the same universal R-process curve. So the question is, you need a site for R-process element generation that acts early in the chemical enrichment history of the galaxy and that produces this robust profile. So importantly, protoneutron star winds, that wind that I just told you about, is a way that you might be able to make the R-process. Remember I said the neutron to seed ratio, that 100 to 1 number, that if that's 100 to 1, then you make all those heavy nuclei. You make these nuclei all the way up to here. If you have a neutron to seed ratio, that's 100 to 1. So the question is, does that neutron to seed ratio obtain in this wind epoch? So what are the physical characteristics of neutrino-driven winds, and are these conditions suitable for a robust R process? The things that set that neutron to seed ratio, that all-important neutron to seed ratio, that number 100 to 1, are the entropy of the flow, the dynamical time scale of the flow, and the electron fraction of the flow. The electron fraction measures how many neutrons you have around. If the electron fraction is very high, you don't have very many neutrons. That's not good for neutron to seed ratio. The entropy measures whether or not you can keep seeds together, in essence. If you have very high entropy flow, it's hard to make seeds because it's so hot. If it's hard to make seeds, then that's good for your neutron to seed ratio. So high entropy is good. Low electron fraction, high neutron fraction, is also good. Dynamical time scale gives you a time, it's like a characteristic time, like R over V, some radius over velocity in this flow in a characteristic point. And this tells you how much time you have to build seeds. If the dynamical time scale is very long, then you have a long time to build seeds, in essence, and that's bad for your neutron to seed ratio. But if the dynamical time scale is very short, you don't have much time to build seeds, that's good. So what we've done is we've constructed one-dimensional models of these, that wind region. I've solved the general relativistic equations for hydrodynamics, in this case, including an evolutionary equation for the electron fraction with an equation of state appropriate to the problem. Let me get to some results. This is velocity as a function of radius. This is for a 10-kilometer neutron star, 1.4 solar masses. These are velocity curves. So I put in a given set of boundary conditions, and I get this velocity out. This is for high luminosity. As I lower the luminosity, the flow changes thusly. So this is 3 × 10⁹ centimeters per second. That's 2,000 kilometers. All the heating is going in down here inside 100 kilometers. So as I decrease the luminosity, I move out. So remember I said there are these three quantities, right? High entropy, short dynamical time scale. Those are what you want for a given electron fraction. So if I made a plot of asymptotic, the entropy in the flow, remember I'm depositing entropy in the flow because I'm depositing energy in the flow. And I make a plot versus dynamical time scale. There's some region at high entropy and short dynamical time scale where the R process is favorable. There's got to be also some region that the wind inhabits. You know, there's a characteristic cooling time for the protoneutron star. There are characteristic neutrino luminosities. These flow profiles can be computed. So there's some region inhabited by the wind. If they overlap, then maybe the R process is favorable in this environment, and you can generate that neutron to seed ratio. So this is the same plot. This is asymptotic entropy. I'm showing you the exact same plot. Asymptotic entropy, this is 250 units of entropy in KB per baryon. And this is dynamical time scale. Concentrate just on this part right here. It's for a 1.4 solar mass neutron star. There's about 100 points here along this line. Each point corresponds to a separate luminosity. Remember I showed you the plot of the velocities going down as the luminosity goes down. Well, as the luminosity decays in a neutron star, you move to longer dynamical time scale because the wind gets slower. And so this is a point for a certain luminosity, then I decrease the luminosity, I compute another point, and decrease the luminosity, get another point, and so on. This region represents then, in time, about 10 seconds of evolution, this whole Kelvin-Helmholtz time that this neutron star is cooling and contracting. This part right here just represents going from 30-kilometer neutron star to 10-kilometer neutron star, and this is for constant radius then. Okay, so this is sort of an evolutionary trajectory in the space of asymptotic entropy versus dynamical time scale. I can do that for other masses of neutron stars. And then I can look at where the R process is in this curve. And this is where the R process lives, up in this region. And what you find is that for a 1.4 solar mass neutron star, you can't get into this region, no matter really how hard you try. For a 1.4 solar mass star and 10 kilometers in radius, you can't get high enough entropy to get up into this regime. You can see at this point you're down by quite a factor, maybe 3 or something like this. And if you're a glass is half full kind of person, you might think, oh, well, you're very close here. You know, why don't you just contract to 7 kilometers or 6 kilometers or something and get into this region? You're contracting from 30, you're going to 10, why not go to 6? Or something. Well, you can do that. You can do 1.4 solar mass object things and go all the way to 6 kilometers in radius, and you can get into this region. But I think you're pushing things. You can also say, oh, well, I have a 2 solar mass neutron star, and let me make it 8 kilometers or something in radius, in a coordinate radius, and you can also get in this regime. But again, I say you're pushing things. So for a canonical 1.4 solar mass neutron star with a radius of about 10 kilometers, you fall short in entropy by a large factor, say 3, over this whole evolution. Yes. Yes.
You just need to basically get into that region and you've done it.
If you get into this region, we'll come back to that. But if you get into this region, I can say that you have a good chance of producing nuclei all the way to the third peak. I haven't said how you produce this universal abundance pattern, which is sort of I'll get back to that. You can ask me. But the main point is that you fall short in entropy by a factor of 3. So what can you do?
Can you change the luminosity?
Yes, I have changed the luminosity all over here. At this point, so for example, let's say if I was right here and I increased the luminosity dramatically. What would happen is the entropy would actually go down, but the time scale would go faster. So the entropy goes down, it's weird. You turn up the luminosity and the entropy drops in the wind. Why? It would seem like you're doing more heating. No. If you turn up the luminosity, you increase the energy deposition. That's true. But that means the matter escapes the heating regime faster. right? You need a time integral on a Lagrangian mass element moving out. If you deposit lots of energy quickly, that's not good. What you need to do is deposit, you know, an amount of energy slowly. So increasing luminosity doesn't do you any good. If you change the profile of the energy deposition, that might be interesting.
But you're doing an atmosphere calculation, right?
So I'm doing a full wind calculation plus the atmosphere.
Suppose there was some outer boundary condition. Suppose the matter was living on top.
That's right.
Pressing down on you. Mm-hmm. Possible that that would, the argument you just made wouldn't be true.
Absolutely. So Chin and Woosley, for example, have made a calculation in which they put an external pressure on this. A tamp, in essence, that you have to do work against in order to get out. And what they find is that the entropy goes up by some amount, by a pretty decent amount, actually. They got 20-30% in entropy, not a factor, but 20-30% in entropy. But the dynamical time scale got longer because the flow then doesn't, you don't have a transonic wind solution. So characteristically, R over V has got to be longer. And so you moved in this direction. And you can see that the slope of this curve, and I'll show you a better curve later, is quite steep. And so going that way fast doesn't help you. Going this way helps. Or going just straight up in entropy helps. So what can you do? There are lots of things we can talk about doing. There's lots of ways you can think about increasing the dynamical time scale. You can say, oh, well, this is for a given electron fraction, right? We forgot about the third thing. Why not just change the electron fraction? Well, there are bounds on that, too. I'm going to talk today, in the last 5 minutes here, just about changing, yes, the entropy.
Why for a
30
kilometer neutron star does
the
entropy fall?
The entropy falls for the most part because if you have a 1.4 solar mass object and it's at 30 kilometers, the binding energy is smaller, right? Wow. So there's less potential well for the wind to overcome. So if you're doing a given amount of energy deposition, the wind matter escapes the heating region faster.
Right, but then shouldn't the dynamical time scale go down as well?
Sorry?
You require less energy.
That's right. If you're at constant luminosity, the luminosity is actually changing across here. So I'm actually decreasing the luminosity as a power law as I go from 30 kilometers to 10 kilometers, which makes some sense. So that's why you're not seeing that effect, but you're absolutely right. Okay? Okay. So what I'm going to focus on is the entropy. What's going on? Oh, okay. Well, that's not important. Okay. So transonic neutrino-driven winds from 1.4 solar mass, 10-kilometer guys, don't produce third peak R-process nucleosynthesis because they don't get that neutron-to-seed ratio, that 100-to-1 that you need. And that could be either because the flow entropy is too low, the electron fraction is too high, or the dynamical time scale is too long. It's concluded by a number of people. So last year, I gave a longer talk based on what you just saw, and after every single talk, somebody said, what about rotation magnetic fields? I said, I have no idea, and that was the end of the talk. Okay, so now I'm going to wave my hands about it and maybe give you at least one idea on what rotation and or magnetic fields might do. Specifically, I'm going to talk about magnetic fields. So here's a picture of the sun. It's a movie, actually. This is from SOHO. You're going to see two comets come in. This is kind of cool. And then you're going to see several coronal mass ejections. Hmm. Looking at this, it's just amazing that there was ever a conflict about whether or not the sun had a wind, I think. But that's for historical purposes. So those two comets, a friend of mine had a course where he put up this thing, and one of the first-year undergraduates said, so comets cause coronal mass ejections? So coronal mass ejections is not really well understood how they're caused. But if we just look at this, we might imagine, at least, that there might be circumstances in which a wind, which I'm talking about a spherical wind, might be modified by a magnetic field. Now, in this case, the sun is magnetically dominated near the surface. Right? B squared over 8 pi, the energy density of magnetic field is greater than the pressure, or rho v squared, for example, the thermal pressure, or rho v squared, which causes interesting loop structures to form, and the like. And the question is, what can we say anything about that in this context? Let me make a plot. So here is log base 10 of P, the thermal pressure, as a function of radius for one of my wind models. This is high luminosity wind model. You can see high pressure, and then this is the radial profile of pressure. Okay? And then this is a low luminosity solution, high and low. You can see that it evolves from high luminosity to low luminosity. Now all I've done is overplot B squared over 8 pi, where B is dropping like a dipole. It's dropping like R cubed for given B zero. So all I've said is here's 10 to the 16 Gauss, 10 to the 15 Gauss, 10 to the 14 Gauss, 10 to the 13 Gauss. The first thing you see is that over this wind epoch, a 10 to the 12 Gauss field probably doesn't do anything. A 10 to the 12 Gauss field just gets stretched purely radially and maybe doesn't affect the flow in an interesting manner. But during this phase, a 10 to the 15 Gauss field, or 10 to the 14 Gauss field even, might affect the wind dynamics significantly. Because in this region, at radii, take this, 10 to the 15, high luminosity solution at that point, that's a radius of about 30 kilometers. That means inside 30 kilometers, you could expect, in this hand-wavy, order of magnitude kind of way, that the magnetic field will dominate, and then you might expect closed loops to form. Maybe in the same way that the solar wind forms closed loops, or that there are closed loops on the sun. And now that's even going to get even worse. It's going to be more magnetically dominated as the neutrino luminosity drops, because as the neutrino luminosity drops, the thermal pressure outside the neutron star also drops. And so if you just suddenly applied a magnetic field, it would be even better. So if I take this 10 to the 15 Gauss field in this low luminosity solution, you could see that this point where they cross is off the page here. It's down at about 300 kilometers. If the field is not like a dipole, if it's more like a split monopole configuration, then these lines wouldn't be as steep. And this point that I keep talking about, which I'm tempted to call an Alphane point, but I won't here, we'll just call it R, changes significantly if I change the radial distribution. So what does this mean? Well, I'm not sure exactly what it means. The real models need to be constructed. But the idea is this. If the magnetic field dominates, maybe you'll have closed loops. If you have closed loops and MHD, then matter will be trapped along those closed loops. But if you're doing heating on that matter, it's trapped in those closed loops, then the matter won't be trapped permanently. So the idea is basically that if you have if the thermal pressure is less than b squared over 8 pi in a region, but you're depositing energy, if Q is an energy deposition rate, ergs per gram per second, multiplied by rho here, the mass density, if you're doing that much energy deposition, then you're actually going to raise the pressure on the material in that closed loop. And if you raise the pressure on that material to b squared over 8 pi, or approximately b squared over 8 pi in this hand-wavy way, then the matter will escape dynamically, just buoyancy, in essence. Well, if you're doing energy deposition in order to increase the pressure, you're also increasing the entropy at constant density and temperature. And this would be a quick estimate for that. You take the trapping time scale, you multiply it by the energy deposition rate, divide by the temperature, and that gives you delta S, approximately. And you can estimate approximately how much the entropy might be enhanced if you put on this magnetic, if you just assumed this magnetic field in my simple one-dimensional calculations, which are not consistent with the magnetic field at all. My point here is only that the magnetic fields, at least magnetar-like surface field strengths, will dominate the wind. So here I'm showing you the same plot I showed you before, except before I had 250 as an upper bound, now I have 1,000 in entropy. And this is dynamical time scale again. That curve that I showed you before is this same curve right here. Low luminosity, high luminosity. You remember that I evolved from sort of low entropy and modest time scale out. Well, in this case, I've just applied the prescription at every point that I just showed you before to calculate an entropy enhancement, which is fake. It's artificial. I haven't done anything self-consistently. It's just an order of magnitude estimate. What kind of, how long does it take that matter to escape a region of closed magnetic loop? That gives you an entropy amplification, and this gives you for different field strengths, 10 to the 15 Gauss, 2 times 10 to the 14 Gauss. This line is that same pink line I showed you before. Goes like this. This is for high YE. At lower YE, this line is lower. Lower YE, this line is lower still. But you can see that the entropy enhancement due to trapping in magnetic fields might be something that's important. So neutrino-driven winds from protoneutron stars with magnetar-like field strengths are magnetically dominated. That I can conclude. In regions where the field dominates P, I expect closed loops. These loops may trap the matter temporarily, but not permanently, probably, leading to higher asymptotic entropy. Depends on the heating rate. It's a very sensitive thing. So this entropy enhancement may be sufficient for a robust R process. Whether or not it is depends on a number of different things. I'll talk about these more if you ask me to, but I'm going to conclude with the future. I'm planning on doing dynamical models of explosion, wind emergence, and evolution using our 1D supernova code that I described in the first part. So we can see, we can somehow get an explosion, maybe I have to seed an explosion, but then I see the wind emerge dynamically, and I can do better studies instead of the steady state models that I've already told you about here. And I'm actually working right now on 2- and 3-dimensional models of neutrino-driven MHD protoneutron star winds. So that same wind calculations, except done in 2- and 3D with MHD, and in essence to see this buoyancy instability, or whatever you'd like to call it, that I just described, these closed loops trapping, heating, expulsion, trapping, heating, expulsion. And since I have 95 slides and you haven't seen all of them, I put the end. Okay, so that's it.